Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, I'm Ben Green, the producer of Science Weekly, which means I'm the one who writes all the bad jokes and comes up with the tenuous musical links to most of our items. Anyway, thanks very much for downloading this edition of Science Extra. Now, we just didn't think it made sense to condense our discussion on the science of consciousness down into 6 minutes. So what you got in the main podcast was some choice snippets from the full interview with our special guest this week, Dr. Susan Blackmore, author of the fascinating book, Conversations on Consciousness. Here is that full interview. It lasts about 15 minutes, and it begins with our host this week, James Randerson, asking Susan more about how and why she came to write her book.
I'd already written two books about consciousness, a big textbook. I gave up my full-time lectureship to do that and spent 3 years writing a big textbook on consciousness. And then I wrote a little easy introduction to consciousness. And still, I didn't understand at all what was going on. And also, I didn't even really understand some of the theories, even though I'd studied them deeply and talked to the people. And I started to make a radio program interviewing various people that I met at consciousness conferences. And I so loved doing these interviews where I could actually get the person and say, but what do you really think about free will? What do you really think about conscious versus unconscious brain parts? Whatever it was that they were arguing about, and pinning them down like that really strongly was such fun. I thought, right, I'm going to make a book out of this, give myself an excuse to go and do some more.
In the introduction, you talk about a problem that actually journalists come across a lot, which is people you interview wanting to change the words that they said to you.
Yes.
What did that cause some problems?
It did. The vast majority of the 20 interviews that I did, the people were fine. And some of the really high-powered people were the easiest of all. Francis Crick made five little tiny changes, which were quite important, you know, that I'd got a word wrong or hadn't made it quite clear, and he put it right. But there were a couple of people, and they weren't the ones I would have expected, and I'm not going to tell you who they are, who were a pain in the neck. And, you know, I said, but you said this. I've got the tape. This is what you said. You must have meant it then. And they said, well, I don't mean it. And, you know.
Oh, dear.
One nearly pulled out. But as I said, there were only two that caused any trouble at all, and the rest were fine. And actually, it was quite fun, because when they came back and said, well, I think what I said was this, and I listened to it again and could tell that it was right, it was very helpful.
Well, one of the real coups, I think, in the book is that you've got this interview with the late Francis Crick, who is the last one before he died. I mean,
That must
have been quite special.
It was very special indeed, and it came about in a strange way. I was at one of the big Tucson consciousness conferences. They happen every 2 years in April, interviewing Christoph Koch, who worked for many years very closely with Francis Crick. And he did a fantastic interview, and I was really pleased. And he said at the end, but why aren't you interviewing Francis? And I said, well, I wouldn't dare. I know he's ill. He's very old. I know he's very ill. And, you know, I wouldn't want to intrude. And he said, oh, you should. Francis is so sick of people who just want to ask him about 1953 and DNA, but he loves talking about consciousness. I'll fix it up for you. And so he fixed it up for me. And the next day I flew quickly, missed a bit of the conference, flew to San Diego, and went and had lunch. His wife invited me to lunch. We had a long conversation by the pool. He even rescheduled his chemotherapy so that he would be at his best at the time that I came, which I appreciated so much. And God, he was tough. I mean, I would ask him questions and he launched in at me and he argued against me. He said, you're a Buddhist, that's why you believe that. And I'm going, and a very great fine mind.
Fantastic. It must have been great memories of being able to do that. One of the questions that you asked everyone is, why is this question? Why is this question of what is the inner self? What is that kind of special understanding of the world that we all have that's unique? Why is that so hard to answer?
I asked more or less the same questions to everybody, apart from about their special areas. And I always started with that question. What's the problem? Why is it a problem at all? A lot of people say to me, well, you know, what's the big deal? Of course consciousness is just brains doing stuff, and they don't see the problem. I mean, how can, you know, neurons doing stuff become this experience of the world? It seems to be a problem. Somehow it's either we've got it wrong, so the problem, we've got to get rid of it, or it really is a big problem that needs a mega solution, like, I don't know, quantum mechanics or a great new discovery analogous to DNA or whatever. So I started with that question every time. And Francis immediately said, well, it's qualia. That is the philosopher's term for, you know, the redness of red, or the wetness of this water, or the feel of this cup in my hand, or the subjective experiences. How can an objective brain, a physical thing, give rise to, create? I mean, I don't even know the words to use. How can it be or be responsible for sensation? That's the problem. And all of them started by articulating that problem in their own way. before launching off into 20 different solutions or non-solutions to the problem.
Ed, if I can bring you in here, I find it really interesting how scientists often move on to consciousness from where they started out. I mean, Crick's a good example, but also in this book we've got Roger Penrose as well, who's obviously more in your realm of things in the physics world. Why do you think that is? You got any thoughts on that?
Well, physicists love to think, and you know, it's like this great gift that's been given to them. I think most, even the most arrogant ones, appreciate the gift of that. And they want to know where it comes from. The centre of their lives is intelligence, and they want to get a concrete understanding of their understanding.
But one of the fascinating things that's happened is a kind of shift from the problem being about intelligence to the problem being about consciousness. And if you go back 30, 40 years, people were still thinking, well, could a machine be intelligent? The Turing problem, Turing tests and so on. Now that we're so used to machines being intelligent and we have them around us, I mean, I reckon my computer's pretty intelligent and all the chips I've got around the house are pretty intelligent, that problem has kind of become soluble in various ways, leaving the question of, well, are these intelligent machines actually feeling anything? Is there anything it's like to be an intelligent robot or an intelligent computer? And the problem shifted on, and I think some of the physicists, like Penrose, have gone with that.
No, absolutely. And do you think it's also tied with the fact that people, you know, in the early 1900s, there was all this stuff about quantifying intelligence? And was it people just realising that, well, you can't? So this other intangible thing.
Oh, but in a way, you can. You can quantify intelligence if you define it narrowly in particular ways. So if you make an IQ test and you say, right, this is what we're going to call a certain kind of intelligence and we can test it, you can do that. And it correlates really well with later performance in life, with ability to do all sorts of other things and so on. But it's a very peculiar kind of human intelligence.
Yeah.
I think what happened later is throwing it all open and thinking, well, actually, this kind of intelligence is what we have because we have evolved to be this kind of creature and we're intelligent this way. Other things can be intelligent in other ways.
The Turing test, actually, that you mentioned leads into another topic I wanted to ask you about, the zombie hunch. Tell us a bit about that. What does that tell us?
The zombic hunch is a term invented by Dan Dennett. But the philosopher's zombie is an old idea, been around in philosophy for a long time. It's this idea. Let's suppose that there is a Ed sitting there, there you are, and then there's another one next to you who looks exactly the same and behaves exactly the same and is in every possible way indistinguishable from the outside. But it's a zombie. It's all dark inside. It's not having any experiences at all. The zombic hunch is the idea that that would be possible. You could build such a thing, you know, with chips inside or, I don't know, it's had a strange mutation or something or another. If you believe that such a philosopher zombie is possible, then you must believe that consciousness is some kind of added extra that's sort of been taken out of the zombie and is put into us at some point or has evolved for some purpose or has some function or whatever. On the other hand, you might argue, well, that's simply impossible. An intelligent creature that could act like you with all the subtleties and nuances of the way you behave would have to be conscious because consciousness is just what it means to be that kind of creature. So it divides philosophers and scientists right down the middle, whether they believe that zombies are possible or not.
So the real question is not that you can sort of imagine it, but that you can imagine that they really could be possible.
Exactly. Yeah. Everyone can imagine it. It's easy. That's why Dan Dennett talks about the zombic hunch. Mm. It's really easy to imagine it. But is that just a trap we fall into and we've got it climb out of it intellectually, or does it really tell us something?
So is this, do people still believe it's a function of complexity? The idea of emergent complexity, you make something complex enough and it shows this emergent behaviour that's not, I mean, the definition of emergent is the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, but there's something a bit more to as it relates to consciousness.
Some people do believe that, and in those interviews, the whole concept of emergence came up a few times. What I've found in talking to people about is that everyone uses the term emergence in a different way. Some people will have an emergent phenomenon that's then an epiphenomenon and has no other consequences. Some people mean that it is actually part of the thing. It's not really different from it, even though the whole appears greater. And I don't think it's a helpful concept in the context of consciousness.
And just finally, another one of your big questions is whether we have free will.
Yes.
And, you know, there was an astonishing kind of array of views on that one.
Well, what astonished me is this. It seems to me obvious that we can't have free will in the traditional, ordinary, popular sense of, you know, I, for no reason at all, not because of anything my brain is doing or anything that's happened in the world, out of nowhere, I can decide to raise my hand or shout or whatever it is, or be a good person or anything. That can't be so. The more we learn about the brain, the more obvious it is that everything causes everything else, and you know, it's a causally closed universe. So I asked everybody, not do you believe in free will, do you have free will? All of these people. I expected almost all of them to say, well, no, obviously not. About half said, well, yes, of course I have free will. And of the rest, really only one was close to what I think, which is we've got to live without believing in free will. All of the others said something like, well, I know we don't, you know, exactly have free will in the ordinary sense, but if we didn't live as though we had free will, all of society would fall apart and everything would be disastrous. And, so, you know, I was really amazed.
So they're almost
that.
Sort of clinging on to clinging. It because they couldn't face leaving it, Ed.
Did anyone invoke quantum mechanics to try and bring back free will? Because that's something that really irritates me when people say that the acausal nature of quantum transitions, that's where you can get the free will. So whatever's behind that acausal effect, that's where free will comes in. That really irritates me because that also demonstrates a misunderstanding of what that is about.
And most of the philosophers would say it doesn't help at all because that just introduces randomness, which is not what we mean. We mean I want to do X rather than Y, not absolutely. I'll randomly accept it. But the people who went into all that stuff most were Roger Penrose and Stuart Hameroff. And Stuart Hameroff in particular really believes that because of the quantum effects in their brain, all kinds of magical effects of consciousness are possible, including survival after death. He was the only one who believed that consciousness could survive after death because of quantum coherence in the microtubules.
I think Ben has one final question.
I should imagine it's probably going to be quite hard to conduct interviews to get research on this. What sort of differences are there between, say, human consciousness and animal consciousness?
Oh, what a difficult question. I don't even know whether you're conscious in the sense that I think I am, let alone my two cats. And I look at them and I think, well, of course they're conscious. Look at them. They must be experiencing the garden. And, you know, but we can't ever know. It's just one of those peculiarities about the whole problem of consciousness.
I have a cat and I think exactly the same thing. I know that he knows what's going on.
But
and if only
knowing...
I could ask him.
Well, yes. You think you know.
I know what Seamus is thinking.
We'll do some telepathy tests with you then.
There we go.
So that was James Randerson asking the questions to Dr. Susan Blackmore, our special guest on Science Weekly this week. The other voice you heard was physics writer Ed Gershner, and I make no apologies for raising the tone at the end and asking a question about my cat. If you've got anything to say about the issues we covered in that interview, and there were a couple of big ones, you can email science@guardian.co.uk, post a comment on our blog, or be our friend and head to myspace.com/guardianscience.
Guardian Unlimited.